Future-Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, there's been much discussion in the past year about how badly the world was prepared for the global emergency that arose from the COVID-19 pandemic. But the truth is, lots of work has been done in the background by lots of people preparing us for all sorts of disasters. Our next guest has a special interest in emergency planning, but for a different kind of disaster, nuclear war. Julia McDowell is a freelance journalist specialising in the Cold War and nuclear threat. And she's host of a fantastic podcast called Atomic Hobo. It's a weekly podcast on how we are preparing for nuclear war and how we've done it in the past. Julia, welcome to the podcast. We've talked about the craziness that goes on in developing these weapons. We've talked about the nuclear fallout and stuff, but we haven't really talked about all of the weird stuff that went on in the run-up to what looked like at one point what was going to be a nuclear war. Can you set the scene for us before we start talking about the different projects that were in place? When are we talking about, and how serious was this threat of nuclear war?
Well, the approach to how you prepare for nuclear war was determined by two things. In the early Cold War, which of course is the late 40s and the 50s, we were dealing with the atomic bomb, which was quite, in nuclear war terms, quite manageable. You could, in theory, survive an atomic war. And so Britain, which is, of course, where all my research is based, still thought of it as being like the Blitz of the Second World War, only a lot bigger. So we still thought you get your guys out with their tin hats and their ladders to rescue you from the rubble, and there'd be some kind volunteer ladies to make you some tea. And it would be horrific, of course, but you could survive it. But then in the late 50s onwards, we invented the absolute monstrous horror, which is the hydrogen bomb. And that changed everything, because you could no longer talk, not with a straight face at least, of surviving a hydrogen bomb war. That hydrogen bomb is absolutely, it's potentially world ending. If you have an all out war using hydrogen bomb weapons, then yes, you are looking at potentially end of the world, or at least the total collapse of civilization. And so things changed then, because you could no longer talk to the public about, well, we'll come along with our ladders and our stretchers and we'll rescue you. You had to try and convey the message that it was hopeless, but of course the government can't do that unless, in case it causes panic. So they had to try and very politely say to the population, look, you're on your own. You'll have to hunker down in your own house with whatever you can gather. But the basic message is, it's every man for himself once the hydrogen bomb comes along.
Right. Well, let's talk about the communications in a bit. But the British government had this plan called the Python. Can you tell us a little bit about it and the thinking behind it and what sort of elements there were of it?
The whole idea of Python is you don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's how I think of it. So before Python, the government's plan for survival was, let's all run away to the West Country, to the lovely rural Wiltshire, where we can hide in a gigantic bunker. But once, as I
Seriously?
Said, yes, there is a huge bunker underneath the countryside of Wiltshire. It was previously a quarry, and then during the war, it was an underground aircraft factory. And so the government took that in the Cold War and they turned it into, it's almost like an underground city. And there are dormitories and sleeping areas and a medical wing and a canteen with machinery down there to whip up cakes. You can have nice Victoria sponge after nuclear war. You don't need to worry about that.
But oh my God.
That is quite incredible, really. The code name for it is Burlington, if anyone wants to research it. There are some great photographs of it online. But as I said, once the hydrogen bomb came along, the government realised, well, this whopping great monstrous weapon, if it lands on our Burlington bunker, which it probably would have done because they had realised that the Soviets probably knew where it was by that point. If the Soviets target Burlington, then we're all gone in an instant. All of government is wiped out. So they took the opposite approach, which was, don't all hide in the Burlington bunker. Instead, we'll divide ourselves up into lots of wee groups and we'll scatter around the country. So some were going to go to old army barracks, some were going to go to castles. There were one group who were actually going to go onto a Scottish ferry on the Caledonian McBrain fleet, which still runs today. And they would hide out during nuclear war on a ferry, which had special protective features to try and keep out the fallout or wash the fallout off the side of the ferry. But they would have been just tootling around a loch somewhere in Scotland trying to evade any blast or fallout. So that was the Python plan. Everyone in who's important, everyone who's anyone, will scatter around the country in these tiny little groups. And the thinking was at least some of them will survive. If, unless we're very, very, very unlucky, at least some of our tiny little Python groups will survive. And afterwards, you can all regroup somehow and form some kind of remnants of the British state to try and put the British state back together.
Which is great for the MPs and HRH. But of course, the general public weren't as well considered. Can you talk me through some of the more practical planning that was laid out when it came to disposing of the dead?
Oh, yes. Well, there was no shelters provided for the British population at all. Of course, during the Second World War, people tended to have a shelter at the bottom of the garden, or you could have sheltered under your local, for example, the underground stations. We all know about that. There was none of that in the Cold War at all, partly because of money, but also because it's again, with the hydrogen bomb, it's pointless. There's no shelter on Earth that can withstand a direct attack from a hydrogen bomb. So the advice was really just fortify your home as much as you can, brick up the windows, pile sandbags everywhere, hide under the stairs, etc. If you live in a high-rise flat or a tiny bungalow or a caravan, then you're quite stuck. But if you have a decent house, try and fortify it and see out the nuclear war in your house. And of course, there'll be no medical aid coming for you. There'll be no one coming to help you. And you might, of course, suffer damage to the house, in which case you'll be lying there injured. You might even have dead relatives in the house. So the advice on what to do with a dead relative was that you wrap them up in a bag. You would have some bin bags handy. You'd wrap them up in a bin bag and you would mark the body with name and address. Hopefully someone comes round to collect the body, but if not, you have to bury them yourself in the garden. And there's, I think it was South Yorkshire Council. They went
this was written down.
Yes, it was dished out in a booklet called Protect and Survive. The booklet was on sale in the 80s, but the plan was if nuclear war drew close, they would actually deliver it to every household and broadcast videos of it on TV. Of course, we never came to that.
But in a nuclear war, you'd have millions of dead bodies. What would they do with that? Everybody digging up their back garden?
Well, what would hopefully happen is that after the nuclear war, the surviving local governments, you would hope that they again had survived in you know, the basement of their town hall or something. Hopefully, if the plan went according to the paper plans, they would emerge and start installing some kind of law and order. And part of that would be collecting the corpses. So the idea would be that the council will come around and they will collect bodies and they will dispose of them. Well, there were plans to get rid of them at sea. I've seen plans in the Edinburgh archives to load the bodies onto a barge and tow the barge out to sea and then just sink the barge. I've seen plans to tip them into disused mines. Of course, there are lots of them in Scotland. God. Tip them into the mines. Of course, the ideal would be to bury them. But then the question was, well, how do we bury them? We might not have any fuel left to work the digging equipment. And what fuel we do have will have to be, you know, carefully rationed. Do we want to waste it or fritter it away just in burying bodies? Because the medical advice was, even if you have piles of bodies in the streets, you don't need to worry about them causing, you know, disease and an epidemic. The biggest threat to public health that they would pose is the threat to morale. It might cause a total breakdown in morale if people, of course, are seeing bodies piled everywhere in the street. So for that reason, above any other, they wanted to get them off the streets. But you can't burn them because they are effectively radioactive waste. After a nuclear attack, of course, they'll be irradiated. So you can't really burn radioactive waste. You can't easily bury them without fuel and digging equipment. So do you put them out at sea? Do you put them in a mine? Oh, do you ask the public to bury them in the back garden? It was never exactly settled because it's an impossible question, as is so much of nuclear war planning. It's an impossible thing because you can't prepare to survive a nuclear war.
What about what we knew about the nuclear bomb and its effect on people? Was there good intel in the early days of what the effect would be on people's health, on skin, on fallout, on kill zones, and so on? Did they know that, or did they test these weapons on on animals or on landscapes? Or how did they know how bad it was going to be?
Well, they did test on animals, which is actually quite a horrific story. American nuclear tests, they had some tests out at sea, and what they would do is they would get ships in the blast zone to test, you know, how powerful does the blast have to be before it can destroy a ship. But tethered on deck to those ships were lots of animals, goats, dogs, and pigs. Pigs were often used because apparently their flesh has similarities to human flesh. So yes, they would tie these poor animals to the ships and then nuke the ships and then carry out tests on the dead animals afterwards. They also did that out in Nevada when, this almost sounds too absurd to be true, but during the Priscilla nuclear test, they tied little pigs up, put them in almost like barrels and put the barrels on the test zone, again, to see how the pigs could withstand the blast. But they wanted to test whether army uniforms could, you know, offer any kind of protection to the soldier's skin. So they had tiny wee uniforms made for the pigs, and they would clothe the pigs in these army uniforms, shove them into the barrels, and then nuke the poor pigs. And when they said that they had uniforms made, I thought that meant they would drape the pigs in some kind of, you know, army khaki or something. But no, they literally had little uniforms made for the pigs.
I mean, it's horrifying, but it's so absurd. I mean, what went on in the American military in the 40s, 50s and 60s? It's every time you go there, it's like the well that never dries up. It's just such a strange place culturally to talk about. So where are we now then, Julie? Is it fair to say that if we had nuclear war now, we have the materials and the know-how to perhaps weather it a bit better?
No, I don't think so. I think, as I say, going back to the Second World War, if we had a nuclear conflict in the 50s, at least the population would have been, if you like, battle-hardened or at least used to it. Whereas now, I don't want to sound like what they call on Twitter, a gammon, you know, one of these older types saying, oh, the younger generation have no idea. But I just think these days we're all far too pampered and safe. Obviously, people in the Western world are referring to far too safe and secure. Quality of life is much, much better for everyone since the days of the 40s. I don't think we would be able to cope with it at all now. I don't think we're far too reliant on, you know, our everyday comforts. Everything is done for us. I think we've seen that during the pandemic. I know in my situation, all I had to do was a few clicks on Amazon and everything was brought to my door. There was no question of any type of hardship. Everything was done for me, so I wouldn't last a second during nuclear war. I wouldn't want to survive a nuclear war anyway. I think Khrushchev was quite right when he said that the survivors would envy the dead.
Well, it is always good to talk about these things, not only because it's a fascinating podcast that you host, and there's lots of really, really interesting anecdotes to give you an insight into how people were thinking at that time, but also because it's important to talk about conflict, about the threat of war, because there is that worry that we will learn to forget the sins of the father and make those same mistakes again, history repeating itself. So do check out the podcast, if only for that bizarre curiosity of that weird time in the past. It's called Atomic Hobo. Julie McDowell, journalist and host of the podcast, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.